Thank you all for coming tonight. We have a lovely, I think, cross-section of Billings, students and faculty, and even some members of Rocky Mountain College here, which I think we need to endeavor to do more of. We should all also thank Director Darlene Hurt and the library staff for putting on this lecture series, as they've done for 5 or 6 years now, all successfully. All a pleasure to attend. So I guess Darlene, did she walk out? Well, the rest of the program will go smoother, I promise. Thank you, Darlene. So last week, Dr. Lin gave a lecture on witches, a bit of an introductory lecture to some of the arguments that we're going to develop over the course of this lecture series. I highly encourage you also to attend next week. Dr. Jay Smith from UNC Chapel Hill will be here, and he will be lecturing from a book of his written a couple of years ago. So if you can, be sure to be here next week. It'll be great. So before I begin, let me say two things about my presentation. The first is that I have, I think, 30 slides, lots of images, lots of quotes. I will move fairly swiftly through them. If you want me to go back to one during the question and answer, that's totally fine. So just note an image or a quote that you want to explore a little bit further. The second thing I'll say about my presentation is that we're going to move from, I think, the lighthearted to a bit more serious by the end of the presentation. So there will be room for laughter, I promise. But as you'll see, the consequences of being labeled a monster, being described as monstrous, could be deadly, as we'll see toward the end. But we'll start with the lighthearted. Okay. So if I asked you all to define monster, if I asked you to define monstrous, most likely you would generate an image, I think, rather than a description. You would probably reflexively conjure up an image of Dracula or Frankenstein's monster, potentially a werewolf, maybe a zombie. But these images that we, again, reflexively conjure up don't always tell us the meaning of a monster, right? I mean, we know that a vampire is a monster, but we don't necessarily know why. We don't know what it means to be a monster. So I'm hoping to shed a little bit of light on that, particularly in early modern Europe. I will ask also from what sources Europeans drew knowledge of monsters. Where was the line, as my title indicated, between the natural and the unnatural, between the divine and the natural, between deviant and normal? So what we call monsters and various other linked terms, like freaks of nature or horrors. What we call monsters is not the same as what 16th and 17th century Europeans called monsters or characterized as monstrous. Right, so we're going to stretch our minds a little bit tonight to try to embody the thought processes of people in the 16th and 17th centuries. Last week, Dr. Lin provided a framework for understanding monsters. Monsters represent similar themes across space and time, but the specificity of fears and anxieties differed across historical eras and geographic regions. One thing historians know is that there is no transcendent standard against which to measure levels of purported irrationality or superstition. All cognitive frameworks, all webs of belief are situated culturally, historically. And during the early modern world, monsters were not simply grotesque, misshapen, frightening creatures that embodied some sense of evil or reflected uncertainties. To be sure, they were all of these things in some capacity, but monsters also represented the porous boundaries of the natural order, intermingling the natural and the supernatural. Monsters elicited wonder, awe, and respect, but they also represented the limits of accepted social and sexual behavior. So in order to unpack the meaning of monsters, I will examine sea and land creatures from foreign continents, the collection of exotic rarities, the creation of misshapen beings through reproductive defects, and the perceptions of bodies of indeterminate sex or hermaphrodites as both naturally monstrous and socially deviant. So, we'll begin, and I hope this setting is okay. Is that all right? Can you see clearly? Oh, good. Okay, great. That'll scare Darlene when she comes back in. Okay, so in his five-volume Historia Animalium, the Swiss naturalist Conrad Gesner produced the most comprehensive account of dragons in the 16th century. Gesner gave detailed descriptions of the appearance and behavior of these creatures, as well as their medicinal properties. He even identified the various types of dragon that existed in the world. They are primarily divided into two species. Those of one kind stay in the mountains and mountainous areas, are large, speedy, fast, and have a comb, sort of a serrated outgrowth on their head. The others live in bogs and swamps, are slow, lazy, and comfortable, and no comb grows from them. Many of them have wings, and many do not. All right, and this image accompanied Gesner's text. And you can see the something of the diversity of dragons. Wings, a beard, horns, right? No wings at all. Gesner's taxonomy derived from multiple sources. The 3rd century Greek writer Philostratus gave to posterity the dragon's crest. The detail about wings came from Augustine of Hippo, or St. Augustine, you've all probably heard of. Augustine also affirmed that dragons lived in caves and were the largest creatures on earth. Gesner's taxonomy also derived from a millennium of misinformation, mistranslations, reclassifications, and exaggerations. So fire production by dragons blended Welsh folklore and descriptions by the 7th century Syrian monk John of Damascus. Right, this is a very well-traveled dragon. Subsequently, Gesner's compendium was mined by other writers. In his A History of Serpents, the Englishman Edward Topsell cited Gesner by name. He reproduced illustrations from Gesner's work and recycled several of the Swiss scholars' classical sources. So I'm using dragons a little bit as a vignette to kind of get us thinking about the history of monsters. For dragons, then, what began in the Greek world as a description of a snake, going as far back at least as Homer's Iliad, became over time a constricting, scaly, flying, fire-breathing, treasure-protecting, lightning-embodying monster. And this was a monster that was perfectly compatible with the order of nature and incorporated all varieties of eels, of snakes, of stingrays, and other reptiles. And in fact, dragons were fate during the Renaissance. There were efforts to basically take a stingray or another kind of snake that had been stuffed, essentially, and then add onto it wings or a horn or something to falsify a dragon. Now, a similar process to constructing the dragon over time contributed to knowledge of sea monsters, especially upon the commencement of the Age of Exploration. These monsters menaced the maps and oceans of the Renaissance, providing both exotic decorations and warnings of the dangers of distant parts of the globe. This image is from 1367, created by the Pizzigiani brothers. And you see, course, not just a dragon who has lifted a sailor from his vessel, but also an octopus down here. This is a pretty small image on the map as well, but it just goes to remind us, of course, what kind of terrifying creatures there are out in the world. In terms of maps, perhaps the most well-known was that of Olaus Magnus, his Carta Marina. Magnus's Carta Marina provided the fullest collection of sea monsters of the 16th century. And the complete title of Magnus's map was Nautical Chart and Description of the Northern Lands and Wonders, mixing both awe and excitement with practicality. The sea monsters on his 1539 map reflect an intriguing combination of invention, information from contemporary resources, and classical authority. Magnus's influential depictions of whales, for example, are original to him and were reproduced by succeeding map makers. Right? Much like Conrad Gesner's text that was reproduced, Magnus's text established a standard that was then reproduced by others. So we'll stick with Magnus for just a minute. The sea monsters that you saw populating Magnus's map were in many ways diverse depictions of whales or various hybrid creatures. You see this one right here. Right? These two sea monsters threaten vessels with their oversized fangs and aggressive streams of water. Again, I'm not sure if everybody can quite see this, but this sailor here is playing a trumpet. Apparently one way to stymie the efforts of sea monsters is to play them music. I don't have an explanation for the trumpet, but I don't think it's effective. up in the top right, this creature is called a Xiphias or Xiphias or Xiphias, whatever you prefer. This is a sea creature with an owl-like face that is at this moment eating a seal while an unidentified creature bites its flank. And again, this is also still Magnus's map. Yeah, it looks like a coloring book. I'm sorry. This is not the original, I can assure you. There's only two extant copies of this map in existence. One is in, I think, Norway, and one is in Basel, Switzerland, I believe. Neither of those two look like this. But here we are. So if you see the red serpent up here, right there, Magnus gave this description. Those who do their work aboard ship off the shores of Norway, either in trading or fishing, give unanimous testimony to something utterly astounding. A serpent of gigantic bulk, at least 200 feet long and 20 feet thick, frequents the cliffs and hollows of the seacoast near Bergen. It leaves its caves in order to devour calves, sheep, and pigs, though only during the bright summer nights, and swims through the sea to batten on octopus, lobsters, and other crustaceans. It has hairs 18 inches long hanging from its neck, sharp black scales, and flaming red eyes. It assaults ships, rearing itself on high like a pillar, seizes men, and devours them. This is a truly terrifying creature. And I just actually noticed this the other day when I was looking. Well, if you see right here, there's a lake of a sort, and there's some kind of sea creature in there. So potentially the Norwegians created the Loch Ness Monster before the Scottish did. I don't know. For us, we want to know where these monsters came from. What purpose do they serve? Now, specific to Magnus, one scholar has suggested that the sea monsters on his map were intended not only to excite the curiosity of the viewer and thus sell more texts, but also to dissuade fishermen from other countries from entering Scandinavian waters. Right? So a cultural and an economic function. So my question is about the lineage of monsters, right? Where ideas of monsters came from. So dragons and sea monsters certainly had a thorough intellectual lineage. They represented the boundaries of what was conceivable in the early modern world, what Europeans could expect to find or be surprised at finding. Many of the sea monsters that appear on medieval and early modern maps are hybrids. Like dragons, the works of classical thinkers confirm the existence of marine hybrids. These ancient sources were filtered through medieval commentaries and mixed with the intentions of early modern contemporaries. And the foundation of many of these marvels of the sea was the ancient and medieval theory that every land creature had its equivalent in the sea. And the provenance of this idea, so far as we know, is from Pliny the Elder, from his text, Natural History. Pliny the Elder wrote, "So the vulgar notion may be true that anything which is produced in any other department of nature may be found in the sea as well." So, sea serpents, right? Sea pigs. You all know what that is. A very regal sea lion, I think. If I had a banner, I would prefer that creature on it. Sea humans, right? Absolutely, of course. Lots of sea humans, actually. The Renaissance saw a revitalization of ancient thought. Greco-Roman texts were found, copied, and embellished. Refurbished classical sources were accompanied by late medieval travel narratives that purported unusual creatures. As the 14th century English monk Randolph Higden put in his World History, "At the farthest reaches of the world often occur new marvels and wonders. As though nature plays with greater freedom secretly at the edges of the world than she does openly and nearer us in the middle of it." So clearly here, nature is gendered. But also the fact that this European monk is expressing sort of surprise at the unknown, right, at the rare, at the odd. First, we should remember that this comes from ethnocentrism, right? Something is weird and unnatural because it's not at the center of civilization, right? It's off to the margins. But of course, we know that now. They didn't think of themselves that way. But by the 15th century, explorers and commentators like Higden expected to find beings as bizarre as headless people, one-legged skiapods and antipods whose feet reportedly faced backwards, and dog-headed humans. Any idea what a dog-headed human could actually be in real life? Any idea? How about a baboon? Could be a baboon. So here's an illustration. The one on the left is an illustration from a 15th century manuscript about the travels of Marco Polo. Although Polo never claimed to have seen such creatures, later Europeans imagined that he did. So on the left, right, this creature here is called a blimai, a headless man whose face is located on his chest. In the center is a skiapod, one-legged creature believed to use his large foot as a parasol against the sun. I guess avoiding sunburn is better than mobility. I don't know. These two beings are being greeted by something we all know that is very familiar to us, a cyclops. And the map on the right is called the Hereford map. And it's from 1280, so it's a little bit ahead of our time. But this is one of the few well-preserved maps we have from the medieval and Renaissance era. It's huge, very large. If you're in my American history class or have ever taken it, you'll recognize the T-O structure. T-O. Hope this works better than that. But the reason I'm pointing out the map to you is that these images, right, these creatures here and a couple others, are all located right along here. Right along the edges, right, just on the margins. This is Europe, this is Africa, this is Asia. Jerusalem is, of course, symbolically and literally at the center. But right on the margins are these creatures that don't conform to what we think of as natural, or at least what they did in the early modern world. Grounded in the evidence of antiquity and the novelty of exotic travel, the belief that dragons, sea monsters, and skiapods existed allowed scholars to take seriously more recent reports of these creatures, right? Real animals with exaggerated qualities. Conrad Gesner reported that the inhabitants of Niederberg, Germany, quote, saw in three different summers during the bright daylight a dragon in the air as if it were hanging there and shaking its tail. We'll come back to that in a minute. What else? For Edward Topsell and Juan Eusebio Nierenberg, the Americas contained a variety of unknown creatures, and unknown people for that matter, actually. These creatures, though, were described as composites of old world animal parts. The Patagonian Sioux that you see here on the right appeared to be a monstrous amalgamation of a lion and a squirrel. In 1499, Vicente Yanez Pinzon found the Brazilian opossum to be, quote, an animal as strange a monster, the foremost part resembling a fox, the hinder a monkey, the feet were like a man's with ears like an owl. For Gesner, Magnus, Topsell, and many others, dragons, sea serpents, and even 12-foot-tall Egyptians and opossums were either consistent with their inherited knowledge of the inhabitants of the earth, or they were possibilities based on natural operations. Overall, they were a part of a coherent worldview. This made sense. Even though they didn't know it existed, it made sense. While monsters may have inhabited the periphery of European maps, by the 16th century, they had migrated to the center. Now, we've already talked about monsters that populated the seas and continents of the Americas, but the desire to explain the unknown came back to Europe in the form of a desire to collect the unknown, right? To possess the marvelous or to possess the monstrous. As we continue to ask the question, from where do monsters come, we are subsequently drawn to the question, why are monsters important? What compelled interest in monsters? We will return to the intellectual framework that allowed monsters to exist naturally, but the age of exploration produced a different interest in monsters. Commerce and an economy of the rare furthered the intellectual challenges to make sense of the unknown. Effectively, the change is that exotic things became commodities. Right? The rarer, the better. As naturalists struggled to order and classify nature, individuals in positions of power began to collect, to display, to trade, and to gift exotic goods. Personalized curiosity cabinets, or chambers of wonder, the Wunderkammer in here, they displayed specimens such as, and this is a random example, ostrich eggs, nautilus shells, whale vertebrae, armadillo shells, prickly blowfish, a mummified monkey claw, and dragon's teeth. Not dragon glass, dragon's teeth, which are most likely shark teeth. And if you can sort of make out in this image here, an alligator, right? It's been taxidermied, various crustaceans and sea creatures, birds of paradise. Again, the idea is to collect not only for scholarly reasons to make sense of nature, but also to demonstrate, right, your possessions, right? Marvelous possessions is what they were often referred to as. These physical artifacts represented tangible evidence of nature's variety and became a central locus for the interaction of science, right? We're not there yet. Natural philosophy is what we should be saying, natural philosophy and commerce. Monsters were, of course, caught in this net, right? Exotic goods turned commodities. So consider the case of Petrus Gonzalez. His name is Latinized. and sort of mixed with Spanish as well. He's from off the west coast of Africa, an island called Tenerife, but his name was kind of altered over time, so Gonzalez or Gonsalves or Gonsalus, whichever you prefer. He was a monster, right, with a body form conspicuously outside the ordinary. But as his courtly robe might equally indicate, Gonzalez was special. As a child, he became a possession of the King of France, Henry II. He was a fixture at Henry II's court. He was treated to both a cultural and an academic education. And Gonzalez fit into the cultural practice of collecting unique specimens. He and other living monsters that became members of court culture had their uniqueness documented, as in this painting. They also had their appearances cataloged. Right? His affliction came to be called hypertrichosis universalis congenita, the Ambros type, or Ambros syndrome, named after the palace of Archduke Ferdinand II of Tyrol, Austria. So the painting of Gonzalez that is extant, that has, you know, come down to us, was a possession of Archduke Ferdinand II of Tyrol. Gonzalez, too, was his property. And Gonzalez's son, who shared his father's prodigious hairiness, was given as a gift within an Italian family. As a side note, Petrus married a French daughter of the court named Catherine. Is this image familiar to you? What does this remind you of? Somebody have the guts to say it loudly. Beauty and the Beast. Right. Doesn't Belle wear yellow in every adaptation? You probably think I'm making this up, aren't you? So I can't say with 100% certainty that the story of Petrus and Catherine is, in fact, the foundation of Beauty and the Beast. But the story La Belle et la Bête was written by a French female author in 1740. Of course, filtered through the Disney imagination through the 19th century and the 20th century. But there is good reason to think that Gabrielle Suzanne Barbeau de Villeneuve, I think was her full name, had Gonzalez and Catherine in mind when she wrote La Belle et la Bête. Right? So just like last week, Dr. Lynn talked about witches and the evil stepmother, right? Here we go again. Right? Fairy tales have their origin in early modern Europe. Right? So to put a bow on this section here, collecting, cataloging, and ordering nature focused on the abnormal, the anomalous, and the monstrous. Organization helped fuel an empirical basis for teratology, which is the study of monsters or the study of abnormal organisms. Somebody was calling in with that Beauty and the Beast reference. Monsters became, in the words of historians Lorena Daston and Catherine Park, suspended between the mundane and the miraculous. Explanations range from the natural to the transcendent. Monsters had to be either fitted into the existing schemes of nature or represented as outside nature, right, as potentially in the realm of the divine. Right, so we're still thinking about this question, what makes monsters? By the time I'm done, hopefully I will have answered it. Historians have a tendency to go backwards all the time and end up in a different place than where they began. I won't do that, though. So what did it mean to be a monster? Right? What did it mean to be monstrous? What linked Petrus Gonzalez to Dorothea, an Italian woman who gave birth to 20 children, to a lamb in 1577 with three bleating heads, to a scaled marine monster found in Poland in 1531, resembling a monk with pontifical ornaments? One answer can be found in the categories of nature unique to early modern Europe. And by one answer, I mean the answer, right? This is it. Early modern philosophers, theologians, and naturalists followed ancient and medieval scholastic sources in opposing the natural to at least three other categories: the supernatural, right, above nature; the unnatural, against nature; and the preternatural, right, beyond nature. The supernatural referred exclusively to God and the genuinely miraculous. That is, when God suspended the laws of nature to punish, to reward, to warn. And historically, monsters qualified as supernatural in this sense. Right? Going back to the Greco-Roman world, monsters wore omens. And if you remember Conrad Gesner's Nidaberg dragon, the Nidaberg episode represented the dragon as an omen, because a few days later, the town burned fiercely. Not because of the dragon. Or, thinking supernaturally, the famed Ravenna monster of 1512. According to the Florentine apothecary Luca Landucci, we heard that a monster had been born at Ravenna, of which a drawing was sent here. It had a horn on its head, straight up like a sword, and instead of arms, it had two wings like a bat's, and at the height of the breasts, it had a pheo, that's the Y-shaped mark, on one side and a cross on the other. And Landucci continued, 18 days later, a coalition of papal, Spanish, and French troops took Ravenna and sacked it, being guilty of many cruelties. It was evident what evil the monster had meant for them. It seems as if some great misfortune always befalls the city when such things are born. So monsters are indicative of something terrible on the horizon. For Christian moralizers, monsters or prodigies is another term they use, something wonderful or prophetic or marvelous. Monsters or prodigies were signs of God's just wrath. Right? They were bearers of a divine message. They were witnesses to communal sin. And this partly explained why monsters often died young, particularly young, especially a few days after being born. Right? If their purpose is to project a message, right, once they have done that, then they no longer need to live. The unnatural. The unnatural was also a morally freighted category, and it referred to particularly heinous acts that violated the normative order of both nature and human nature. Right? In this category, the unnatural enveloped things such as patricide or infanticide or bestiality. Unnatural acts transgressed the moral dictates laid down by the author of nature. In contrast to the supernatural and the unnatural is the category of the preternatural. The preternatural was a morally neutral category, or at least morally elastic. It referred to things or events outside the quotidian order of nature, but still due to natural causes, no matter how oddly related. Preternatural phenomena were rare and unusual. Even though they existed on the edges of nature's boundaries, they were in principle fully explicable by natural causes. Right? These were not miracles. Right? They were natural. Even if odd, they were still natural. The category of the preternatural included a lot. Right? I'll mention a few of them. Petrifying springs. Rains of frogs or blood. Individuals who slept for inordinate amount of times, right, like Rip Van Winkle. But also, a child born brainless, was preternatural, and hermaphrodites, as we'll get to in just a little bit. So by the late 16th century, when the category of the preternatural became a prevailing one, Europeans had experienced a cultural, social, and religious decentering, or at least disorientation. The age of exploration upended the moral place of Europeans in the world and revealed heretofore unknown peoples, right? Peoples unaccounted for in the Bible, right? Creatures that were not yet classified. The Protestant Reformation that Dr. Lynn talked some about on Tuesday last, the Protestant Reformation challenged the dogmatic beliefs and institutional structure of the Roman Catholic Church, creating multiple paths to heaven, and as a consequence, pervasive religious warfare. And add to that, the 16th century witnessed an intellectual transition, the early stages of the scientific revolution. And like the so-called scientific revolution, monsters embodied both what we would call modern scientific approaches and vestiges of superstition. The preternatural blended naturalistic explanations with attention to the odd and often fanciful efforts of nature. And monsters became ornamentation in cabinets and part of nature's diversity, but also frightful representations of something gone or going wrong. So teratology became a literary genre and a cultural touchstone as a response to the upheaval experience. Everything Europeans had known, right, was completely upended during the 16th century, right, which is why the category of the preternatural becomes so important to them, right, at that time. Again, it was just flexible enough to incorporate everything, to provide some explanation for everything. So one of the most well-known writers in this field of teratology, of monster studies, was a French physician named Ambroise Paré. And he wrote one of the most well-known texts on monsters in the early modern world. And that was his text on monsters and marvels, right? Cleverly named. So I'm going to use his opening paragraphs to explore the meaning of monsters and to kind of give some shape to the rest of our presentation tonight. So according to Paré, monsters are things that appear outside the course of nature and are usually signs of some forthcoming misfortune. And there are several things that cause monsters, as you can see here. I gave them all to you. Should have given you a handout, maybe. So the first is the glory of God. The second, his wrath. The third, too great a quantity of seed. The fourth, too little a quantity. The fifth, the imagination. The sixth, the narrowness or smallness of the womb. The seventh, the indecent posture of a pregnant mother. The eighth, through a fall or blows struck against the womb of the mother. The ninth, through hereditary or accidental illnesses. The tenth, through rotten or corrupt seed. The 11th, through mixture or mingling of seed. The 12th, through the artifice of wicked spittle beggars. I won't explain all of these, but that one I feel like I should at least say something about. Wicked spittle beggars. These were individuals who would usually either sit outside a city's gates or sometimes inside of a city, and they would feign an illness of some sort to elicit sympathy and thus elicit money. There's a story of one individual who took the arm off of his friend, I suppose, that had died, and kind of rigged this dead, festering arm up to his shoulder, put his other arm behind his back, and would then go to doors and knock and ask for money. All right. So that's the wicked spittle beggar. The 13th, through demons and devils, right, as you would expect. So Paré, in this initial investigation of the causes of monsters, expressed a mixture of awe, of wonder, of excitement, fear, and scientific curiosity. Now, his explanations for the creation and purpose of monsters joined ancient and medieval traditions that treated monsters as natural, if unusual, combination of matter, to monsters as portents or omens that revealed future events, to monsters as a part of nature's delightful and unpredictable variety, and in the Christian tradition, to monsters as ways for God to communicate its presence, foretell providence, and address sin. Now, monsters may have had supernatural or preternatural or just plain natural explanations and meaning, but Paré does not count monsters as unnatural. Right? They are not inherently grotesque or freakish or horrifying. In early modern Europe, there was no single dominant definition of or explanation for monsters, which again is why the concept of the preternatural is so important. It allowed contemporaries flexibility, especially at a time of religious, political, and cultural rupture. For example, Martin Luther and followers of the Reformed faith expected to find prodigies and monsters. These creatures were omens that detailed the rampant sin and corruption of the Catholic Church, and Lutherans, followers of the Reformed faith, used monsters as propaganda. Which is why, if you remember a couple of slides ago, we saw the what was called the monkfish, right? The scaly monster with the habit of monks, right? That was found in Poland, right? Of course, right? Poland was deeply Catholic, right? So of course Lutherans used that as propaganda to say, see, God is punishing for all those years of Catholic misbehavior. Let's do remember that the Catholics weren't the bad guys in the early modern world. Catholic supporters, of course, had their own interpretation of Protestant monstrosity as well. But for the rest of my time, I want to focus on the view that monsters were natural, if unusual, material beings. They were malformed bodies that, if you noticed, how could you not, were the responsibility of women. So I haven't mentioned Aristotle yet. Which I know you all have been waiting for Aristotle. But Aristotle is still crucial to the early modern world. Aristotelianism, the various accretions to Aristotle's thought over time, was still an integral source to 16th and 17th century thinkers. And in the Aristotelian view, monstrosities are most succinctly failures in the purposive effort of nature. Aristotle viewed monstrosity as a graduated scale of imperfection falling away from the realization of the intended perfect form, which is the human male. Since the particular end of nature in animals is that like produce like, to quote Aristotle, even he who does not resemble his parents is already in a certain sense a monstrosity. The birth of a female, following this logic, is a first departure from the intended perfection, but nevertheless a natural necessity for the continuation of the species. Reproduction, in Aristotelian accounts, was about male semen dominating female matter. If the formal agent, male seed, is deficient or weak or lacking heat, then the progeny will not resemble the father. Similarly, according to Paré, if the mother's womb is too small, nature, wanting to create two children, finds itself lacking, so that the seed, being constrained and crowded, then comes to be coagulated in a glob from which two children, thus joined and united, will be formed. So for Paré, too great a quantity of seed on the left-hand side, right, a large amount of extra matter would yield conjoined twins, each almost perfect in form. on the right side, lacking the quantity of seed. If the quantity of seed is deficient, then one or more members will also be lacking. Both, though, too great a quantity of seed or lack in the quantity of seed, both demonstrated the failure of male seed to dominate female matter. And I can't help but comment upon this. I don't know if you saw a couple of weeks ago in Virginia, there was a two-headed copperhead snake found. I thought about putting an image up here for you to demonstrate, but if any of you are like me and are totally terrified of snakes, that would probably have you on the floor. The idea of there being a two-headed snake is literally my nightmare. There's nothing I fear more than a snake. Two heads, you've got to be kidding me. Okay, so women's bodies, right? Something about women's bodies is crucial to the production of monsters. Women's bodies in particular were to be controlled and governed, but they often resisted, undermining not only the transmission of male resemblance and paternity, but also patriarchy and social order. Paré's fifth cause, the imagination, referenced the errant and disorderly cognitive faculty that, like women allegedly in general, was considered inferior to the prevailing male rationality. Paré wrote, "The ancients who sought out the secrets of nature have taught of other causes for monstrous children and have referred them to the ardent and obstinate impression that the mother might receive at the moment she conceived through some object or fantastic dream of certain nocturnal visions that the man or woman have at the hour of conception. This is even verified because the imagination has so much power over seed and reproduction that the stripe and character of them remain imprinted on the thing bred." The maternal imagination. According to Paré, women have between 30 and 40 days to form the child. And it is in this window that women should be shielded from terrifying imagery. So this creature here, this creature was the product of folk medicine in 1517. A woman with a fever was advised to, quote, "take a live frog in her hand and hold it until said frog should die. That night, she went to bed with her husband, still having said frog in her hand. Her husband and she embraced and she conceived, and by the power of her imagination, this monster had been produced." The maternal imagination that produced monsters continued to be a viable theory into the 18th century. Even Peter the Great of Russia noted in one of his writings in 1718 the effects of the maternal imagination. And this idea of women's imagination having so much power would continue in literature into the 19th century and probably into the 20th. But in the late 17th century, the famed French philosopher Nicolas Malebranche argued that the more delicate body of women was not, quote, without some weakness and was often disturbed by some passion during pregnancy. The ruptures women experienced affected their fetuses. Children's bodies would be impressed upon while in the womb. Their physical features changed according to the intensity of the mother's imagination and agitation of the sensory network. And Malebranche noted a number of examples. A mother who literally bore fruit because her imagination and desire were strongly fixed on a pear. There are multiple accounts of mothers giving birth to children with pockmarked faces. And Malebranche goes into long detail. I won't read you his passage, but into great detail about a mother who gave birth to a son whose body was broken in the same places in which those of criminals are broken, because the mother attended an execution while pregnant. Mothers, then, through the maternal imagination, became the formal agent in shaping the fetus rather than the male semen. I hope you can see where we're going with this. Malebranche applied updated scientific knowledge to explain monstrous births and monstrous bodies. Similar to the work of Paré and many others, women were responsible for monstrous births, but not simply because they gave birth. Women's imaginations were considered unbridled, and they were not capable of rationally controlling them. One of the key explanations for monsters, then, was women's constitutional delicacy, their unruly imagination, and the fact that they could not stop themselves from focusing on a pair or attending an execution. But let's add to that. According to Aristotelian thought, a monster was more narrowly characterized as progeny that does not resemble its parents, an unnecessary degeneration from the goal toward which nature worked. And this theory was augmented, to give just one example, by Fortuny Lacenti in 1616. And he argued that there were really two elements of monstrosity involved: the deformed child and the aberrant mother. Right? The mother's imagination circumvented the laws of nature and produced a false resemblance. The product is monstrous, but so is the process. Perhaps most stunning to men in the early modern world was that the ungovernable imagination of women was one of the few ways women could exercise authority, at least facetiously. The monstrous child bore witness to the violent desires that moved the mother at the time of conception or during pregnancy. The resulting offspring carried the marks of her whims and fancy rather than the recognizable features of its legitimate genitor. The monster thus erased paternity and proclaimed the dangerous power of the female imagination. So the important point here is that by the turn of the 17th century, women were not only a primary contributor to the creation of monsters, but their own bodies and their indiscriminate imagination were monstrous. Women's deviant creation of monsters subverted the patriarchal order and had social, legal, political, and sexual repercussions. Every monster produced represented the inability of men and the male seed to master women and their bodies, especially at a time when queens and queen regents ruled in England and France, and at a time, as we saw last week, when women were expected to cavort with the devil. This same fear of empowered women influenced the perceptions of hermaphrodites as monsters. And for the sake of clarity, I suppose, I'll use the term hermaphrodite. That was the term used historically. If we were having this conversation about the 21st century, we'd probably prefer the term intersex bodies. So you've seen this image already, right? This was the Ravenna monster. Part of the monstrosity of the Ravenna monster was its hermaphroditic nature. Hermaphrodites were not novel to the early modern world, but they did become ensnared in a new set of tensions related to sexuality and urgent moral and social concerns. Now Paré, going back to him, he combined Hippocratic explanations for the birth of hermaphrodites with the tradition of Aristotelian approaches. According to this tradition, the sex of the fetus was determined by two important oppositions: between the male and female principles in the maternal and paternal seed, and between the left and right sides of the uterus. This is sort of a Punnett square, almost. Paré linked the principle of maternal and paternal seed to the Aristotelian notion that the formative virtue always tries to make its likeness. And the result of this was a set of four possible hermaphrodites. The male hermaphrodite with functioning male genitals and non-functioning female ones. The female hermaphrodite, which is the opposite. Hermaphrodites who have sexual organs only used to urinate. And the last group are true hermaphrodites, to quote Paré, those who have both sets of sexual organs well formed and they can help and be used in reproduction. Right? Rare, certainly, but nevertheless possible. And that final category, right, the true hermaphrodite, this gets us closer to unnatural territory, right, as opposed to preternatural. Right? It reveals, too, how naturalizing monsters cemented restrictions on non-male bodies. The misuse of sexual organs violated the natural order and the social order. So in Paré's words, both the ancient and modern laws have obliged and still oblige these latter to choose which sex organs they wish to use, and they are forbidden on pain of death to use any but those they will have chosen on account of the misfortunes that could result from such. For some of them have abused their situation with the result that, through mutual and reciprocal use, they take their pleasure first with one set of sex organs and then with the other. First with those of a man, then with those of a woman, because they have the natures of man and woman suitable to such an act. On both sides of the 17th century, there were multiple legal cases involving true hermaphrodites or women with hypertrophic genitals, individuals whose perceived abnormalities were conflated with hypersexuality or transvestism, but always associated with deviance. So the question became, were there real hermaphrodites? Or were hermaphrodites really lesbians who used their enlarged genitalia to replicate heteronormative sex? The first carried the stigma of being monstrous. The second added unnatural to the characterization of monstrous, as well as the legal charge of sodomy and the theological charge of a mortal sin. Sex in the early modern world was a legal condition, and women who attempted to take on the identity and status of men subverted the alleged natural roles of fathers, husbands, laborers, and rulers. And these cases reveal anxiety over sexual ambiguity and the slippage between the monstrous and the unnatural. Right? Hermaphrodites were monsters, but lesbians were unnatural. The female body, her imagination and reproductive organs, became an anatomical monstrosity, transgressive of the laws of nature and transgressive of male authority. Paré's work in general dealt with causes of monsters, and he did often evince sympathy for them. But Paré also moved from an observation of causes of hermaphrodites to a prescription for appropriate behavior. Moreover, it was men like Paré, right, surgeons, physicians, naturalists, who presided over court trials and advised rulers. Medical opinion could and did dramatically alter the lives of individuals, forcing them to conform to one sexual and subsequently gender identity, forcing them to leave their marriages or submit to dangerous surgery, and sometimes condemning them to exile, to imprisonment, or to execution. So, how did we get tonight from the bouncy account of dragons and sea cows to the all too familiar characterization of women's and intersex bodies as monstrous? Well, I hope to have drawn attention to the flexibility of the category monster in the early modern world. I hope to have shown that monster, that nature, are not timeless categories, Right? They don't have an essence. They're not unchanging. Although we still think with the category monster, the line between the early modern and modern worlds is full of twists and turns. Physical evidence may not change, but certainly contexts and meanings do. I also want to remind everyone of something that we, I think, intuitively know. Those who have control of language, those who have control of categories of thought, those who control the law, they get to determine what counts as licit or illicit, as deviant or normal. And while sea monsters and hybrid creatures tell us about the capacious possibilities of nature in early modern Europe, the maternal imagination and hermaphrodites tell us about the consequences of nature for real human beings. The potential to encounter dragons in the Atlantic Ocean did not stymie the age of exploration, but the capital punishment meted out to a woman who gave birth to a child with canine features, or the near execution of a male-dominated hermaphrodite, demonstrate the political, social, sexual, and legal ramifications of monstrosity. As nature became wide enough to include monsters, they drew wonder and awe, but also terror and repulsion. The comprehensive umbrella of monster had the side effect of restricting the bounds of society. Women's bodies became as unfamiliar and grotesque to many early modern Europeans as the Ravenna monster or the Patagonian Sioux. Thank you. Sure.
Okay.
I ended early specifically for that.
Okay. So we're going to run the questions a little bit different so that we have a good recording on the audio. So if you have a question, would you raise your hand? And then I'm going to bring you this microphone, and then Dr. Brian will answer.
Do we need lights, or is it okay like this? Okay.
Yep. So does anybody have a question?
I'll let you do it. Turn the lights on. Does anybody have an image they want to see again? Not yet? Okay. Did I cover everything?
Yeah.
Pretty comprehensive? Great question. So, first off, who had authority over bodies in the early modern world? Right. Well, the church, partly, but men, right? University professors, men who, you know, were allowed to go to university, who were often priests or clerics. So, first off, we have to realize that there is authority based on being the man in charge of bodies. Right? Women were often midwives. Women knew, you know, what we call folk remedies. But through the early modern world, this was the time when credentialed men with authority used their authority to sort of disallow women's sort of natural knowledge from their experiences of being a woman, but also being midwives. This period of time, so obstetric gynecology, there's different approaches to how to give birth. Should women sit down, lay down, sit on their particular seats that were made for women? This was also a moment when the nature of female genitals was being learned. Right? I mean, men in positions of authority didn't know that much about the vagina. right? Really, they didn't. In fact, this period of time is called the discovery, or rediscovery in parentheses, of the clitoris, right? Men didn't know that much, so they had to use this classical knowledge to make sense of how do you produce children? Do men and women combined through reproductive fluids create a child, or is it simply the male seed that does it? Right. So my answer really is that they still didn't really know a lot. Right. I mean, the 16th and 17th century saw changes, not always for the better. And depending on who you asked, you would get a different answer. These were still debates between surgeons, physicians, clerics and priests whenever they chimed in. Yeah. Yeah. I don't know if John Merrick's mother was blamed in the historical record or on screen or something. I don't know. But the maternal imagination was, again, a way to make sense of why would a child be born to look like a pear? Really, I mean, it sounds so silly, but without X-ray, right? Without, you know, the kinds of tools, instruments that we have now, you have to make sense of it. And it had classical heritage. Right? She would be categorized as commodified, racialized sexuality. I mean, really, so the Hottentot Venus was a woman from a tribe in South Africa, and now I've gone blank on the Khoikhoi tribe in South Africa who ended up coming to Europe and being essentially a part of a freak show because she had a large bottom and could be dressed up to look like a Khoikhoi woman. Basically, the men in charge of her took advantage of, you know, this sort of exotic sexuality. Right? She would fit as kind of the moment when classifying nature and organizing nature was not done out of a sense of wonder and awe, but out of a sense of generating authority, I think. I mean, the Hottentot Venus became a possession, a commodity, but also a source of knowledge, of racialized knowledge, right? This is how African women look and behave, right? So natural, just purely natural, right? A nice place to begin for racism. I actually thought about including the Hottentot Venus tonight, yeah, as a bookend. But.
So, a little bit of a more modern question.
Okay.
So, like, movie monsters from the 20th century, Nosferatu, Lon Chaney, Boris Karloff, even, let's say, Leatherface, from Texas Chainsaw Massacre. Now, obviously, we know, you know, Nosferatu and Swamp Thing, they're not real, but we're still intrigued. These monsters. What do you think that says about our modern hopes and fears?
Changes over time. The modern fear of the Nosferatu vampire isn't the same as the modern fear of the zombie, right? I mean, the zombie would be more akin to our fears of viruses and diseases, something like an AIDS or Ebola or swine flu or something like that. And also a sense of impending doom. So I would say you would have to go to look at the context. You know, where did Nosferatu come from? Right? Is this off of a Bram Stoker model or a previous model? Is it from Russian folklore that's been, you know, ginned up in 1920s Berlin for some reason? So there's no real simple answer. There is a cynical answer in that once monsters become popular and Hollywood can make money off of it, then they'll support any script that has to do with monsters. I think also we Americans have an unhealthy obsession with violence, And so Leatherface is, just one of many, I think, representations of that. Maybe we're getting more creative in our monsters, but that also shows a weird obsession with violence, but also a deep-seated fear of, right, the unknown about what's out there. I mean, yeah, that's as close as I could get for a wide-ranging question, I suppose. Yeah.
So yeah. My question, not really a question, but a comment.
Okay, hold on just a second. Let Darlene get you the microphone so it can be captured on the recording.
Mm-hmm. Had a slide that showed the sailor playing a horn for the monsters.
Yeah.
And I don't recall what year that was.
Mm-hmm.
But there is that quote about music charms the attitude.
Right.
Like that.
Right.
So I don't know if that was first or if it's
yeah. No. No, you're well. I can't say that it is, but you're absolutely right. Was it Cerberus? The dog-headed monster that gets put to sleep by the Leer? Cerberus? Yeah, yeah. Or better known in Harry Potter and in the Chamber of Secrets, I think. Right? I'll put you down here. That's yes, but the image was from 1539, and now you say that, I think you're probably exactly right, that this was something from the classical world, right? Just how do you tame a beast? Play music. Yeah. Yeah, good point. I'm glad you said that. There's one right over here. Yeah.
So going back to the beginning of your lecture,
mm-hmm.
What is the possibility that a lot of those pictures and diagrams were exaggerated? Because if you look at the dragon per se,
yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
I thought it was like a beamer, personally. So, I mean, if you've never seen a beamer
yeah.
before, and you bring back a story, what's the possibility that it's all exaggerated?
The possibility is 100%.
Okay.
I mean, it's absolutely. I mean, these are real creatures that people see, but they see through their preternatural lens, they see through their classical lens, right? And they're also to try to sort of get into the mindset. I mean, how, I don't know about you, I'd be scared to death to be on a rickety wooden ship in the middle of an ocean, right? So that's gonna exaggerate what you see. I'd be scared to death to be in Brazil in 1516, right? Remember, I don't like snakes, let alone spiders that are this big, right? So again, the filter that they had sort of heightened everything that they saw. And like the Patagonian Sioux, they see this creature, I don't know what it actually was, necessarily, or if it was just completely made up, but it's probably something. And again, they see, well, there's a little bit of a squirrel, there's a little bit of a lion. So this is just, a combination of what nature has already created, right? And that makes sense to me in my mind. Right? Yeah. Follow up?
Yeah. So who's the first guy you talk about? The dragon?
Conrad Gesner. Yeah. 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 So the question is about dragons in Asian culture. They grew up actually completely differently. There was, I think, Marco Polo's travels. He brought his conception of dragons to Asia and then brought back from Asia their conceptions. And so they sort of kind of blended in some ways there. But their origins were completely different, completely separate. Yeah. Fair question, though. Oh, in fact, yes.
It is interesting that multiple cultures have dragons. You have to wonder where that comes from.
Right. Well, it comes from big snakes. No, I mean, it does. No, I mean, really. This is where, I mean, really, this is, I mean, there are Indian pythons that are huge, and let me remind you, terrifying.
Komodo dragon.
Komodo dragon. Yeah, I mean, again, these, I mean, we think of, if the dragon origins were of a snake, but they were also Komodo dragons, right? With wings or with feet or with scales or not with scales, with the beard, with the crest, right? All varieties. Yeah, and that's part of the tale of the dragon, I guess no pun intended, is for us in Western culture, Homer's Iliad. And then over time, Greco-Roman worlds coming into further contact with African cultures, cultures in what we call the Middle East now, and Indian cultures, and so they brought with them what they knew about snakes to these new animals they're finding and merging the two together to create, again, a dragon that breathes fire and that is the cause of lightning. Right? And there's real, I mean, they thought they saw these things, but they're exaggerated. Right? There was one in the back door. But a lot of the dragon stuff, I mean, it's you know, this is all very fun and entertaining, but a lot of it's really boring that guys along the way just mistranslated, right? From Latin to Greek, or Greek to Latin, or from Arabic to Latin. They just mistranslated things. And so you get, you know, a crest instead of a beard or something like that. Now or in the early modern world? In the early modern world. Well, sure. Well, I mean, what we're talking about is genetic defects. Right? That's it. They just use the term monster because for them, monster represented an omen. Right? You see the Ravenna monster and you think, Sicily's going to burn. Right? Or Sicily burns and you realize that you saw a monster 3 days ago, cause and effect right there. Yeah, so again, the monster to them didn't inherently mean a bad thing. Right? I mean, it carried something with it. Either it was prophetic, or it was the product of the maternal imagination. But it wasn't always the monster's fault. Right? Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So my question is you said dragons, a common theme is that they hoarded, you know, gold. So were they ever used?
Later. Yeah, the hiding treasure would come a little bit later and was the least important. I mostly threw that in there for fun. But it was a part of the generation of the dragon myth. Was there a moral attached to it? I mean, are you thinking of The Hobbit?
Yeah.
Certainly. I mean, certainly there. I mean, all of these, the monsters that we're exploring in this lecture series carried some kind of moral with it. Of course, for women and women's imaginations, the moral is that women's bodies are unpredictable, right? That's not really a bedtime story you want to tell your kids. Right. This isn't the bedtime story lecture necessarily, but yeah, there's always some morality with it. And I didn't talk about vampires, of course, and werewolves, but next week if you come, Dr. Smith is going to talk about a set of wolf killings that could have been construed as a werewolf and what that means for going out at night and going out alone and all these kinds of things. So...
My second one.